Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 97 of Connectivity. I'm Scott Thompson. We have four segments for you this week. Kicking the show off, myself, Justin, and Neil talk about the two big Nintendo releases this week, Pikmin 3 and Mario & Luigi Dream Team. After that, we have our second segment about the Tropes vs. Women series. That's with Carmine, Josh, Dave, and Julia. Following that, we have our first ever This Week in Nintendo segment with myself and Neil. And closing out the show, we have Don's interview with the CEO of Image & Form, who just released SteamWorld Dig this week. Enjoy.
Hey, and welcome to, I guess, kind of these new Nintendo games that we're going to talk about. First, I want to talk about Mario & Luigi Dream Team, and then we're going to talk about Pikmin 3 with Justin Baker.
Hello.
And Scott Thompson.
Hello.
So I wanted to kick this off a little bit and kind of do a little bit of a rant on Mario & Luigi Dream Team, which sounds kind of preposterous, as we were just discussing before we started recording, that I gave it an 8, and I'm kind of like very... I have this bad taste in my mouth regarding that game, which seems kind of counterintuitive, but it just, like, I mean, it's still a very quality game. There's just certain things about it that kind of, like, break it apart. Like, it never shuts the fuck up, and it just feels like it's Bowser's Inside Story Part 2. Not even 2.0, just Part 2, because it doesn't really evolve much. It kind of just, like, it's as if Bowser's Inside Story had, like, this secret second quest that, for some reason, displayed in 3D and used a gyroscope instead of the microphone.
The Final Fantasy IV after years of Mario and Luigi.
I mean, that's a little harsh, but yeah, I mean, similar.
Well, because I was reading the review, and like I was just telling you, I was real excited about Dream Team because I've never done any of the Mario and Luigi games. And so I was like, all right, this is my one. I'm going to jump on, and it's going to be great. And then I read the review, and I was like, oh, well, this is just a gigantic recommendation for the superior previous title.
Yeah, and that's the thing is, like, it's I recall reviewing a Super Monkey Ball game on 3DS that came out at launch, and I played that game, and it was dog shit. And I was like, did my taste just change? Does Monkey Ball suck now? And I went back and played the GameCube game. I'm like, no, this is still great. And that's kind of what I felt like when I was playing Dream Team. And I went back and played a little bit of Bowser's Inside Story. Is that there's a lot... It's like the whole game's a lot snappier. And Bowser's Inside Story still has some pacing issues. Don't get me wrong. I think if I were to review Bowser's Inside Story, it would probably get a 9 somewhere around that ballpark. Like, I don't think... it's definitely not a game to me that is a 10. Although I could see an argument for that from other people. Depending on your opinion.
I mean, it seems like one of those things where if you've played Bowser's Inside Story and you're chomping at the bit for more of that, then yeah, Dream Team sounds cool. But someone like me who's never played any of them, Bowser's Inside Story still sounds like the go-to one. If you only play one, that's the one to go to.
Yeah, and it wasn't even until like seeing what other people were saying about the game that I did kind of realize about just how much... the game never lets you explore. Because there were a couple parts where I actually kind of was just like, oh, I can go get this thing here. And the game kind of didn't really let me do that. But then I would come back there later in the story. You almost do like 2 laps through everything in the game. And then the game's fucking like 30 plus hours long. Which, for a Mario & Luigi game, is super, super long. Because all the other ones, I think, probably a leisurely playthrough is still 20 hours or so at best. Yeah.
Out of curiosity, if someone just really didn't want to go back to Bowser's Inside Story, whether they just don't want to go back to an old DS game or what have you, and they haven't played it, would this game, would they feel better about this game than you do just because it seems more unique and fresh to them?
Yeah, definitely. Okay. Even if you've kind of fallen off the wagon, like maybe you played Superstar Saga, and you kind of are just like, well, you know, Bowser's Inside Story, Dream Team, it's a toss-up. I don't really want to play a DS game and save $20 and play the superior game.
Yeah.
I can just play this 3DS game and download it on my 3DS. Like, right. If you do that, like, that's the thing. That's why I'm really down on Dream Team, but it's still a very good game. It's just that it's like the kind of thing where, like, I know there's a better game in this very series that still holds up pretty fucking well.
Yeah.
That, like, there's nothing broken about Dream Team. It just drags.
It's like a sequel to a really good movie that isn't bad, doesn't necessarily do anything wrong, but just doesn't... Yeah, okay, so it's like Die Hard 2.
Yeah.
Die Hard 2 is fine, but it just kind of repeats what the first one did, and it isn't really remarkable in any way. But then Die Hard 3 is awesome.
My personal stance on, you know, like Iron Man 2 is that Iron Man 2 just kind of gave you more of the same of the first Iron Man, but it wasn't fresh.
There you go.
And it falls apart in the second half, but, I mean, and I guess the same thing happens in Dream Team, so yeah, that does work.
Because that's where I am. I played Superstar Saga, and that's the only one I've played. So, like, I'm still on the fence about this one. But I don't think I'll go back to Inside Story.
Yeah. I mean, like, that's the thing. Dream Team is still a quality game. It's just that I think Bowser's Inside Story is better. It's been a long time since I played Superstar Saga. I feel like that might not hold up as well as I think it would. But I think I would sooner... Okay, granted, I just played Dream Team, so this is kind of a bullshit answer. but I think I'd sooner go back and play Superstar Saga in, like, a couple years than ever play Dream Team again.
Yeah. Wow.
Like, this is a game, if I didn't have the review copy being downloadable, I'd be selling the fucking shit out of it right now. And I didn't think I'd ever do that with a Paper Mario or Mario and Luigi game, but then I did it with Sticker Star last year.
Sticker Star was garbage.
But yeah, okay. On the disappointment scale, Kulafi actually asked me that on Twitter. I would say that no, this does not compare to Sticker Star at all.
Okay, because Sticker Star, I mean, that game was just straight up garbage. I wanted to call someone and get my money back after that one.
Yeah, I was all excited. Like, I went out to a Target. It was the morning of my sister's fucking wedding, I think. I went out to a Target and I bought Sticker Star. That's how excited I was. Or it was the day after or something. I don't know. But I was very excited to play that game, and I really enjoyed, like, the first, like, few hours of it, and then got to a point where I'm like, oh, shit, that's what they're doing.
Yeah.
I think I played it for a couple hours and then realized that nothing new was going to happen after that point, and it was a lot longer. And I was like,
I played two levels with an FAQ up, and I realized that this isn't fun. And then I turned off the game and never played it again.
Yep. Yeah.
Not a fun.
But let's get to something that, at least thus far, and I definitely played the least out of everyone because I was kind of in the march to finishing Dream Team. Pikmin 3, which came out last week. On August 4th in North America. It's been out everywhere else for like 3 years, I think. I know. I think Super Mario 3D World's coming out in Europe tomorrow. we've still got a 4 month wait for that one.
Yeah.
But anyway, yeah, Pikmin 3 is fucking gorgeous.
You know, as a side note, before we really jump into Pikmin, I kind of want to just make a note about that. We got an email from Nintendo because we put up Don's review of Pikmin 3. Like, before the European embargo, but he had played the Japanese version.
Yeah.
And, like, really, if you're going to complain about breaking embargoes based on region, just release everything at the same goddamn time. Plus, it seems seriously. Like a detriment, because, like, all these Pikmin 3 reviews came out, like, what, 2 or 3 weeks ago now, and then the game releases, and you've kind of, like, lost that buzz. You know, like, if you released it all at once in every region, you had all the reviews go up, like, 2 days before the game launches, then you're riding
that
buzz.
Well, I think a lot of that happened, a lot of that, as far as I can tell... if you've noticed, I don't think Nintendo's released any game worth shit in July for, like, the past 4 years. Like, I think Mario Strikers Charge might have been the last July release they've had.
Yeah.
I'm not 100% sure, but I don't think I'm too far off. If there's anything, I don't think it was too notable. For some reason, I think Nintendo of America, like, their research or what they expect is that releasing something in July is dumb. Which, I think I kind of disagree, because I think there is that summer vacation culture, but maybe, I mean, they probably have more numbers than we do.
Well, it might have been a bad idea in, like, the mid-90s, but times have changed. I mean, come on.
I mean, we're looking at that now, and we're kind of, I guess, bleeding into other discussions now, but for Nintendo in North America, like, you've got the major Wii U game and the major 3DS game, you know, in, like, the last major release was Game & Wario in Animal Crossing.
Mm-hmm.
And you have these two games, and then you basically have one game for 2 months.
Mm-hmm.
Which, I mean, it's just... I don't know. It's like, it's an odd... Like, I feel like you might be in a better position to kind of spread out Pikmin 3 and Mario & Luigi. Which I don't even think Europe really did. It's just that they had that come out in July. Oddly enough, Switched, where Mario & Luigi, I think, came out a week before, and Pikmin came out about a week later.
Well, plus at the same time, if you play Pikmin... Well, I guess we should establish how many hours in are each of you?
I've played 2 days, so I'm barely...
Oh, okay.
Okay. So you're like 20 minutes
in. I really wanted to play more of it, but I just haven't had the chance. Work has been hell.
I'm probably, God, what am I? I'm like at day 13 or 14, maybe.
Well, I'll put it to you this way. I finished the game in just under 30 days, and I was playing pretty leisurely. I mean, I wasn't trying to speed through it, but I also wasn't 100%ing anything. So really, I kind of feel like most people are going to finish it before Dream Team even comes out.
Probably.
How many hours did you put into it?
I was just over like 11 hours and like 15 minutes.
I don't know. See, my thing is, I think that's a good length, and I mean, especially coming after Dream Team.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like it was a good length, but for $60, man.
Yeah.
I mean, this is a full price game, and I beat it in 10 hours, and I don't want to say anything about the ending, and we'll talk more about it, but it just, I wanted to spend more time in the game, and ended, and I was like, oh, okay, I'll go do something else now, I guess.
Well, to me, that's like the game as a whole. I mean, even individual days, I'm like enjoying myself, and then it's like all of a sudden I have to artificially end it.
I hate the time crunch so much. Yeah. That's one thing that, I mean, I've been back and forth on even buying it, and then I finally caved. Now, I'm glad I did, because the little bit that I've played, I'm blown away. Like, it's like, okay, it's, you know, an evolution of the series. You know, it might not be something groundbreaking and new, but it's just like, hey, you remember that formula from Pikmin 1 and 2? Yeah, we refined it, and it's real nice.
It's a great Pikmin game.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the thing. It doesn't really bring anything too new to the table.
Yeah, but I mean, I thought the whole game was great, but like Scott was saying, I mean, I want to spend more time in the game. Like, give me more of this game. It's great. I want more.
Well, have you played the mission modes and stuff like that? The challenge modes?
Here's the thing about the missions. I've done the collecting fruit ones, and I didn't do the boss ones because I've already fought all those bosses, and honestly, the bosses, about half of them were really frustrating to me, and the other half were all right.
Yeah.
And then I haven't done the other ones, but even then, unless it unlocks more, that's only like 15 missions, you know, which is cool. Like, I played some multiplayer with them, but it's just not a boatload of content, you know? I mean, it feels like a great platform to add on some DLCs and mission packs and stuff like that.
I think they're doing that, right?
Miyamoto kind of talked about it a little bit in a roundabout way.
He was probably just like, you know, we'll probably do DLC for Pikmin the same time we make a new F-Zero game. And then he pulled out his dick and dropped it on the table.
And I feel too like that's hurt by the fact that I don't know how much, at least with the story mode, you really want to replay it. Like, in the beginning, it's so damn slow. Very slow. Yeah. And I mean, it's kind of like what you're seeing with Mario and Luigi here. You know, it's very guided in those first handful of days. And I can't see wanting to, like, I enjoyed it the first time through, don't get me wrong, but I can't see wanting to go back to that.
Is there a way that we know of that you can, like, skip those story segments if you were to replay it? I feel like there might be.
I haven't gone back. I mean, what I'm planning on doing is starting again on my last day and just going and doing other areas, so I've already finished all the story. Because, I mean, you have sort of a, you know, you've got the day right before you finish, so you can keep playing there.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's probably what I would do and go from 100%.
Yeah,
I mean, I guess my thing, and this is probably just different stances on what we expect in the length of a game, because I always get shit for this whenever I complain about it, and I did on Twitter, thanks the guys who gave me shit for it. but I made a comment about how I'd rather play like a real polished like 5 to 10 hour experience than drawn out 30 hour one. And I truly believe that. It has nothing to do with the way I died, like, you know, jumping from game to game to cover it for Nintendo World Report or anything. It's just personal preference. Unless this game is like the second coming of Christ, like, you know, whether it's Animal Crossing or Fire Emblem, which are games that I put a shit ton of time into, like, I don't want to spend 30 hours with every game. And I like finishing games. And that's why the idea that, I mean, Justin, you say that, oh, it took you about, like, you know, 11 hours to beat Pikmin 3. To me, I'm like, all right, awesome. That sounds great. Aim for between like 10 and 15 hours in finishing that game. Maybe I'll go for 100%, maybe I won't, but that sounds like a great length for a game.
Yeah, that actually works really well for me because I'm not playing it on my own. I'm playing it with my wife. We're playing it together. And so like to find 30 hours where we could dedicate to a game isn't really going to happen, but like 10 to 15 is really that sweet spot where we can, over the next couple of weeks, play like an hour every night and then be done with it. Not like we're going to rush through it, but just finish it, which will be nice, rather than like getting halfway through and then not going back to it or something.
Yeah.
I feel like, I mean, I'm definitely in the same way. Like, I've been enjoying shorter games as of late, but I think I enjoy whenever a game says, all right, well, here's the main game in this short 10 to 15 hour segment, and then you beat that, and it goes, oh, here's extra missions, or here's something to do. I mean, the extra content is like, oh, well, here's 15 missions that you're going to beat in less than an afternoon.
Yeah.
And then now go play more of the story again. It's like, well, you know, I feel like for as long as I've waited for Pikmin 3 and as long as they've hyped it and they're like, this is
it. Nine fucking years, man. That's how long it's been since Pikmin 2.
And they're like, this is it. This is the Wii U game. It's going to sell you on a Wii U, you know, and I just feel like there's not enough content, and it would have been so easy to just add in a few extra areas. Or, I mean, heck, the missions are so small and
or
short.
Add an online that, multiplayer.
Yeah, well, I mean,
yeah, I mean, Bingo Battle Online would be awesome.
Yeah, that's like at first, I'm like, well, you know, like I think there should have been parts of Nintendo Land that should have been online, like leaderboards and shit. But like a lot of those Nintendo Land games in multiplayer wouldn't work.
No, they wouldn't be fun online.
Yeah, I mean, and like that I understand. With why Pikmin 3 is not online, like that doesn't make any fucking sense.
No.
Like, the more that I see of that online multiplayer, or the local multiplayer, and I have Lauren with a loose commitment to play some Bingo Battle with me at some point, is that like, that's the kind of thing that like, if we could just have the fucking gamepad, the microphone and the gamepad, and work on it together, be like, oh dude, I'm going over here to get this, and you're like, alright, cool, I'm gonna go over here with the other guy. Even three player co-op, like that'd be fucking crazy.
Well, and in my situation, especially, like I'll beat the story mode and then I'll do all the cooperative challenges, but I probably won't get much out of Bingo Battle because my wife won't want to play competitively.
Yeah.
Because you know it's just not as fun for us. We do, you know, it's not like when you're just trying to fuck around with your friends. You know, we're not gonna have that competitive edge.
Yeah, I don't know how long it'll last.
Yeah, so I'd like to have that opportunity to play with other people, but with no online, that's just not going
to
happen.
We'll just have to wait until PAX East.
Yeah, oh, man, that's true. That'll be awesome.
Use a round of Bingo Battle, take a shot.
What control scheme do you guys use?
I go Wii Remote and Nunchuck, and I have the gamepad sitting in my lap.
I was on gamepad, and we talked about this the last time I was on the show. And I talked about how much I dislike Nunchuck and Wiimote, and I'm a controller guy all the way. And for the last level, I did use the Nunchuck and Wiimote.
And wasn't it so much better?
It was more accurate, but I don't like the Nunchuck Wiimote combo. I don't know what it is. I think it's how I sit on the couch and the fact that I have to point it at the screen. Like, I'm always, like, laid sideways on the couch like some kind of human slug. So it's always this kind of weird maneuvering. So
I loved this old ancient ass episode of RFN around Super Mario Galaxy time. I believe it was Evan Birchfield made a comment about how he played the game where he has like his hands with a Wii Remote and the Nunchuck like behind his head pointing downward as he's playing the game. I believe I might be misremembering that a little bit because it's like 60 years ago. But I just distinctly remember that and, like, having that moment where I'm just like, yeah, I've played games like that on Wii. Where, like, they want you to point at the screen and you're like, oh, man, fuck you. Like, my hands are back here. They're not moving.
Yeah.
I don't know. I think it comes from I'm very tall. Like, I'm over 6 foot. So sitting on normal-sized furniture that's for human beings is never comfortable. So I always have to, like, lay weird or sideways or slump down. So maybe that's part of it. I don't know.
It's yeah, I mean,
like... No, go ahead, Neil.
No, I mean, for me, I'm also 6 foot, or 6 foot plus, if you will.
Well, how do you do it? I mean, I can't stand the, like, sitting there with my, you know, my feet planted firmly on the ground and my little nunchuck and my Wii Remote. I've got to be, like, thrown sideways like a throw rug.
See, the funny thing is I just, like, kind of sit back, especially with this game, I kind of sit back because you don't need to be super anal about where you're pointing on the, in the, well, if you're using a Wii Motion Plus, at least. You don't need to be super anal about pointing directly on the screen. It works kind of like Skyward Sword did, where like you just kind of need to like point in an area, and then it will usually be gentle about where it calibrates you.
Mm-hmm.
But like I'll usually sit back, and I just have like my knees kind of raised a little bit so I can glance down at the map, which that is definitely not ideal. I did sit on the floor and play for a little bit so I could have the gamepad in front of me, but that's what I still haven't quite figured out. But that's also an asinine thing where you need to have the gamepad and a Wii Remote and a Nunchuck, and how do you go between the two? And I like it. I think it offers a lot of cool possibilities for, like, looking to see what's around there. But there's also the part of me, like, this probably would have been better if I just, like, hit the plus button and the map came up.
Yeah. I mean, it. I tried to set it where I had, like, the little stand, not the charging cradle, but the stand that comes with the Wii U to hold the pad up, and then I'd sit back on the couch, but then I was too far away, and I just I couldn't get comfortable. Maybe I just need a new couch.
Yeah,
I
think is what I'm getting couch. At here.
Yeah, just screw it all.
And then you'll be like, fucking Pikmin 3 was $60 and the price of a new couch. It was only 10 hours.
Thanks, Nintendo. God.
Well, I, my wife and I have kind of turned the single player into a cooperative experience. Where
I like how before it wasn't your girlfriend, it was Tabby, and now it's just your wife.
Yeah, well, that's the title, so that's what it's going to be. Well, like, when I'm talking out loud, I say wife, but when I, like, tweet, I always say Tabby. I don't know why. But I tweeted this today, actually. But we kind of turned it into a cooperative experience where each day we just alternate between one person, you know, controlling everything and then the other, manning the gamepad and sort of observing the map, finding things and, you know, spotting fruit and that kind of stuff. And that's been fun. It's been a good way to kind of get both of us involved and make sure we don't miss something. Cause when I'm playing by myself, I definitely like don't look down at the map enough and I miss fruit and stuff that I should be seeing. So it's been fun to play that way. I've really enjoyed
it. Yeah. I'm super excited for the weekend when I can just play the shit out of this game.
Well, and that's the thing, too. I think we've nitpicked a lot. So I kind of want to, if just for a minute, because I know, Neil, you need to get going. But just if we could talk a little bit about some of the positives, because I think we came at this, like, just wanting to nitpick, because it is a good game. Right off the bat, I want to say I love the intro when you have the three pilots falling to the planet, and it says Pikmin. Shit looks epic. I mean, I loved that. Just that shot of when the title appears.
I really like the way that the game, I mean, it does take a while, and it is very wordy, and it kind of, like, teaches you things twice. But I do love the opening, just because it is kind of cinematic, because you start off as one captain, and then he gets attacked by something, and then you jump to the next, and then you find out that the other one's in trouble, and you have to go save her, and then that's as far as I got. So what happens after that? But I haven't nitpicked this shit. I just like to point that out. I mean, I really enjoyed what I've played so far, and I can't wait to dive in.
Yeah. Well, my biggest nitpick is I want more, which is hardly even, you know what I mean? It's like, it's so great. I need more of it. You know.
I really hope they do DLC for this. I mean, even if it's in the form of just like some more missions, but I think they could do some really crazy shit with that.
Yeah, I don't buy much DLC, but I would definitely buy DLC for this game. I like too, Neil, you talked about the captains and finding the captains. I like too that it's built into the story, sort of reuniting the captains, but it also sort of, I don't know, it kind of like gradually teaches you how to use each of them and you see how puzzles become more complicated when you have to, you know, split between the three and, you know, split into three smaller parties to solve bigger puzzles. It's very cool.
I think it works really well in how they introduce the captains, just because it does kind of give you, like, okay, this is what you do with just one guy. And, I mean, even if you're familiar with Pikmin games, it's nice to get that little refresher, see how it controls on Wii U. And then it introduces the second one, and then it introduces the third one. I would assume that things get more hectic and you have different guys going to different places, and that just seems really fun. And it seems like it's very manageable in how everything's presented. And that's why the gamepad does help out in that end, because you can just, you know, go down there and once you touch the screen, it pauses and you could move around the map anywhere you want and direct a guy to go somewhere.
It's also real forgiving in the sense that if you're not going to, like, I, for the most part, kept my guys all in one big blob. And then every now and then I might do two parties, and really rarely I would do three parties, but They don't railroad you into you have to play three parties all the time to get anything done or be efficient. I mean, you can kind of play it like old school Pikmin and just whenever you hit those puzzles, which is what I did.
Yeah.
But I don't know. My favorite thing in the whole game was, and this has been my favorite thing of Pikmin overall, is it's the world and the ambiance and especially the music in this one. The music is awesome. And it's all just so damn cute.
And it
I
is.
Love it.
It's adorable.
The whole
except
time
for
I'm
the
just
noises.
Like,
some of the noises of the captain speaking.
Yeah. The way, when they're talking, annoying. I'm upset. But when Pikmin are out there, I'm just like, no.
It's giving Lore nightmares. Like, it's not a good thing.
Yeah, the voices are kind of weird.
Yeah, it's kind of strange. It reminds
there
me
a lot of whistles. I think I saw Jeff Gerstmann tweet about how blah, blah, blah. he tweeted about how it would be nice if there was different, like, funny noises that you could put as the whistle noise. Mm. And I agree. Make that DLC. Just like a fart sound or like a Mario coin.
I love the whistle in Pikmin because it's one of those things that if you're playing it, you will never get annoyed by it. But if you're anywhere within earshot, you're immediately frustrated that someone is doing this to
That's why Lauren then turned down the volume after the third, like, meh, meh.
I was also incredibly impressed with the fact that you could just at any time, at any point during the game, hit the minus button and put it just on the gamepad.
Yeah.
To the point that I was sitting there during cutscenes flipping it back and forth really fast. I was so, like, every Wii U game needs to do that and be that seamless with it, period.
All right, well, I think that's going to wrap us up for this segment. We will likely revisit Pikmin in greater detail, likely with Andy Gergen, when he's not on the road. Because I know that he gave that shit a 9.5. He loved the hell out of it. So I hope you enjoyed our little bit about it. And if you have any questions about this or any other upcoming games, you know, all two of them that we know about right now. Just kidding. Any questions about this or Mario & Luigi Dream Team, write them in to connectivity@nintendoworldreport.com. We would love to answer them. And we know that we've gotten some emails and questions, and we will probably handle them soon. So send in more, and it'll be an even better segment.
There you go.
Thanks.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.
Welcome to this connectivity segment, part two of where we tackle media critic Anita Sarkeesian's Tropes vs. Women in Video Games video series, and all the topics surrounding that. Our staff panel today consists of Josh.
How's it going, everybody?
Dave.
Hello.
Julia.
Hello.
And I'm Carmine, your host. So, I think we should start out by acknowledging how thorny this topic is. I mean, in fact, right before this, guys, you remember we had an argument going off in our staff chat room.
Yeah, a little one, little one.
Yeah, a little one that went on for like 30 minutes. And I do agree. I mean, I remember the first time I watched the first video in this Tropes vs. Women in Video Game series. My brother and I had to stop it partway through because then my brother and I had to get into like this like heated discussion over like how we reacted emotionally to it. And I mean, just to give some background to people who haven't heard of this, Tropes vs. Women in Video Games, it started out as a Kickstarter last year where people donated money to see this video series get made, and it was very successful. And now the video series covers is a review of video games and how women are represented there, and specifically tropes, meaning these patterns and plot devices that seem to get used and used and reused, and just an examination of that. So early on, I think we're talking about the damsels in distress trope. And I don't know, there wasn't as much Nintendo games in this second one, which I think was, the first one was very historical. But it was a little harder for me to watch as a Nintendo fan. The second one, I was less on the defensive, I have to admit.
Well, yeah, I mean, this one had like, I mean, it had Pandora's Tower in it, which, I mean, you know, Nintendo. But the second one, I think it focused more on like, you know, it had like Time Splitters, it had like Kingdom Hearts, it had, I think it even had like a Crash Bandicoot thing in there. But it was, you know, more cross-platform. It wasn't, because it was more modern, it, you know, a lot of games are cross-platform. It's not just Nintendo who's doing these things anymore. It's everyone. Everyone across the board is doing everything.
Yeah, I think maybe one of the reasons why this one was a little harder to watch is because it was talking about contemporary games, and making the important point that a lot of these issues aren't really going away. This isn't a thing of the past, and it's something that you know, we should be mindful of going forward is, you know, how is this medium that we like to think of as an art form, you know, how is it maturing? How is it growing? Or is it maturing or growing? So,
well, hey, not everyone likes to think of this as an art form.
Well, that's true. But I think the fact that it is, you know, I don't know if you can try to keep something that is a creative work from, you know, becoming an art form as it matures, right? It happens to everything. It happened with movies. It happened with television. I think it'll happen with games too.
Well, I mean, I'm not going to argue with you because, you know, I do agree with you. I mean, I'm just kind of for a hot second, if I can still say that phrase without being criticized, taking the devil's advocate, being a devil's advocate, just because, you know, some people still don't consider it an art form. That's why they don't see this whole thing as even a threat, which is, you know, or not threat, but, you know, whatever we want to call it. I don't know.
It's... Well, I think you mentioned something in the emails that we had leading up to this discussion, Dave, where we did have these, like, two different camps, maybe, that reacted to this in different ways, where one camp said, we don't need, you know, someone coming in and nitpicking everything, because this is entertainment, you know, it's just games, it's supposed to be harmless fun, no one should take it seriously. And then there's another camp that really wants, like, a really hard look at this sort of thing. And I think you asked, how do those, are those two viewpoints from different groups of people? I mean, I guess I would say yes.
I don't necessarily agree there. So if you look at movies, I would, you know, I'm sure I'm going to draw lots of gunfire for this comment, but, you know, take the genre of, like, chick flicks. You know, you can say that, okay, you know, maybe this in some way objectifies women and relationships. And then I might fall into that category. But at the same time, I found her reviews on her general commentary just right on, even loving Nintendo games as I do.
You're talking about Sarkeesian now?
Yes. Yeah.
Well, I think, you know, the question is, when people are responding to this sort of critique, is it, you know, so and you have one point of view that's like, well, these are video games. These should, it's fun. It's a pastime. It should sort of be immune from this critique. And then separately from that, you have people saying, you know, video games are an art form, right? So Roger Ebert a while ago made the statement that video games are not an art form and can't be an art form, and people took offense to that.
Well, I mean, yeah, and I'm going to go back to the whether or not we can, you know, criticize it or whether or not, you know, we just need to enjoy it. But I'm going to take that ever popular middle ground. And yeah, well, I'm going to say, I think that we should, like, yes, sometimes games like the Deadpool game is just a dumb game that there's objectification in there. It's just a dumb shoot 'em up game. There are games like that. And there's also like games that are pieces of art. You know, depending on who you talk to, it could go, you know, Super Mario 64 could be a piece of art, or even the first Crash Bandicoot, Jak and Daxter, Last of Us, if we're going, like, over to PS3 or Sony. But I think that we should all realize that when a game is not, like, when it is just stupid, senseless, whatever, just, you know, ignore it, don't treat it like it's something it's not. But when a game is trying to be something more, and we're enjoying it, we should also be able to, at the same time, take a step back and realize what it's doing, what it's saying. Because, you know, we can't, I don't think that all video games are trying to be art, though. Because sometimes, just like how all paintings are not, you know, the same type of art. Sometimes they want to provoke, and sometimes they're just silly, and they're to be enjoyed. But I think that as a whole, the medium just needs to, everyone who wants to be able to at least discuss this in a reasonable way needs to be able to take a step back after enjoying the game, or even while they're enjoying the game, and see, and just to be able to have a adult discussion. I don't know. I think it's a bad phrasing, but I think that having a little bit of both doesn't help. It doesn't hurt. It does.
Yeah,
help.
Maybe I agree with you. I mean, maybe it's wrong to, like, look at this as an either or. I mean, I want to have both Bridget Jones, like, going back to the movie analogy, which I think is pretty telling. I want to have both Bridget Jones's Diary in my collection, as well as a foreign film that won an Academy Award, like you know, like nowhere in Africa, and they really do fill different gaps. And I mean, even in one person, you can watch both things. But what do you guys make of, like, I mean, Sarkeesian says this, you can enjoy these games, but at the same time, you can also know that, you know, it's really overusing this trope, or maybe it's having this effect on our culture. I mean, do you think that, how socially responsible do you think video games have to start getting these days? I mean, I think Nintendo, in a way, sort of is less featured in this second video because Nintendo doesn't take a stance. You know, they don't really go into plots, so they just stick to the archetypes, and they don't really try to do the things that a lot of modern games do when they're trying to kill off their female character.
I mean, I think it's worth asking what are the archetypes that they're sticking to, right? And, you know, some of them are some of those archetypes are problematic. And like, you know, the concept of the damsel, that's the character archetype. And I don't even think that Sarkeesian suggests that is an archetype that should be completely eliminated from media, just that we should be mindful of its use and not consistently fall back on that, because what it does is it creates, you know, certain expectations about portrayals of women that sort of bleed over just into the cultural expectations of women. So,
I think that's very well said. And I would add that, you know, I would say in many of the cases, particularly the ones that she points out, is that it's not really necessary, I think, to advance the story. You know, there can be many other motivating factors that can be used that are much more constructive, I think.
But I agree with you guys. I'm not about to fight that. I agree that we shouldn't abolish it altogether. I also agree that it's, maybe we are overusing it a little. But I also ask that, like, with games like, you know, the Mario series, where they're not known for their story, they're known for their gameplay, like, should we start expecting more out of them than Princess Peach being captured? Or, you know, I mean, when a new game comes along, it claims to be, like, the next great game, and they don't always have, like, you know, a damsel in distress, or, you know, they have really creative plot devices, things you never see coming. That's what helps make them a great game. And, but, you know, sometimes they're going to have a damsel in distress. So should we hold Nintendo specifically, since, you know, it's what we're here to talk about, should we holding Nintendo, like, their classic games to the same standards that we're holding every other game? Or are we going to let that slide? Because, you know, they're not coming out and saying that they want to, they're not here to make you think in a different way,
yeah,
aside from gameplay.
So if I could just respond to that. So I think a lot of people often misinterpret the purpose of feminist critique or any kind of critique in that regard, right? I don't think that Sarkeesian wants Nintendo to stop having Mario rescue Princess Peach, right? I think that the idea is, if we can have a better understanding of why there's these archetypes and why they're used the way they are, you know, perhaps this will allow for more creativity in general, you know, not making specific prescriptions for how to construct stories, but to say, hey, you guys are falling back consistently on the same old tired, you know, sexist representation of women, right? So, yeah, I don't think we should say, Nintendo, you know, you guys need to make your storylines differently. But, boy, you know, it'd be great if Metroid Other M never came out with that plot.
I don't think anyone here is going to argue with you.
Right, and that's the perfect case where if they would have just been more mindful when they were writing that story and doing the presentation and everything, I think that could have been avoided.
I've actually heard someone defend the Metroid Other M plot and say that, you know, it's unfortunate that the reaction was that way because it really wasn't intended to be read that way.
Well, that's never really, I don't think...
Once the audience gets a hold of it, it is what it is.
Yeah, especially in this day and age.
You know, and I think even Sarkeesian would argue, it's not that these developers and writers set out to be sexist. Okay, they don't set out to disempower women. It's just that it's a habit that's that does reinforce these kind of disempowering attitudes that's used out of comfort and laziness.
And I think that, like, a major difference I saw in her, I guess, her, I guess, stance on Nintendo. I think that in the first episode, she really put forth that Nintendo had an outsized effect on the video game industry, just partly because of what the video game industry was at the time, and that it's kind of, you know, almost propagated into this much larger thing. I think in the second episode, she put much less of the social responsibility on Nintendo, I think. You know, because it's, you know, while a lot of these other games have become very violent, very, you know, I think far more extreme than, you know, the classic Mario and Peach example. But I mean, I do think that there is an element of social responsibility. Like, if it's not advancing the plot in any meaningful way, then why not take the tack of social responsibility?
Well, I mean, you know, they're moving on. Like with Luigi's Mansion, there wasn't a damsel in distress. It was a brother in distress. But yeah, I mean, like, you know, so they are at the same time, like, I want to give them credit because they are at the same time making steps forward. But at the same time, for every step forward, they're also staying in the same place. Because with every new Mario game, Peach just gets kidnapped again. Or, you know, Peach is not getting kidnapped, and then she's kidnapped again. Or Peach is going go-karting, and then she gets kidnapped again. But, you know, it's not every game. And we do have to, you know, give them credit where credit is due. But, I don't know, I agree with you. I don't think any of us here are going to outright argue anything that was just said, unless Carmine is something that he's burning.
I, for one, am happy that we get to play her again in Super Mario 3D World. So I'm good there. But, you know, like I said before, Nintendo isn't out to... This isn't their goal. And I think the second video, being more contemporary, shows that, you know, there's a lot more industry out there. And, you know, if people do want to start saying, let's be contemporary, let's start, you know, taking this thing and making the claim, which a lot of games now do, that they're, you know, they're so, you know, intense, they're dramatic, they're emotional, they're good, they're well-written, and they're cinematic. I think we should try for, you know, higher standards of narratives and higher standards of plot devices. And one thing I really like about Sarkeesian's stuff is that it's great to have this stuff to talk about because she's giving us, you know, she's describing how you can approach this, how you can look at it. And then also she's just going, like in this video, she's going and she's showing like an example, repeated examples of how modern day games in the past decade have been carbon copies of a certain trope. When she goes into the video and she says, your wife dies and then you have to save your daughter, she jumps to another game and she can say the exact same thing. I think it shows that there's still a long way to go if we want to make these claims that games are improving. And maybe Nintendo's not the one to do that, but, you know, we've got a whole, there's a lot of other companies that, you know, if they want to do this, you know, we should start taking a harder look at it.
Well, and, I mean, I agree with you, though, that maybe Nintendo isn't the one to do this right now, because while you were saying all that, I was thinking of one game that everyone claims to be great, and it is great, and there's no, you know, your wife dies, and then your daughter, you have to save your daughter kind of thing. And that game is, you know, not for Nintendo, although one day I hope it will be, and it's Journey. Journey, there's no gender role, there's no anything. There's just you on a journey. Sometimes you'll meet someone else, and sometimes they'll be with you the whole time. Sometimes you'll meet a bunch of travelers. But in the end, like, it's still this wonderful cinematic game that, you know, doesn't rely on gender roles to push forward the plot, which, you know, I think says something for video games is that not all video games need a damsel in distress.
Well, no, and I don't think the argument, right, is that every game is like this. And actually, Sarkeesian sort of has foreshadowed the next episode, in which case, you know, she's going to look for games that don't fall back on those tropes and perhaps even subvert some of those tropes. And I'm really looking forward to that. But you're right. I mean, there's always examples out there of games that do it right. But it's really all about preponderance. And you know, the way that she goes through example after example after example after example, it's very incisive. And in fact, you know, when she finally gets to the bionic commando bit about
his wife is part of him.
I mean, his wife is his arm. I mean, I think we all have to stop and say, like, wow, this this is bad, right? I mean, this trope has been taken to the point of absurdity.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, don't get this. Well, we're not gonna get into that right now, but. We do got to say that, yeah, for every good game that comes out that doesn't, you know, have to rely on a certain trope to move its plot forward and is a creative and all-around great game, that there are 10 or 20 shitty games that come out. Like, you know, that's just how it is. And there are a lot of really bad games that have really lazy writers. Believe me, I've reviewed a bunch of them.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, I think it's worthwhile to point out that, like, even movies, you know, they still have a lot of this thing going on. And video games is, you know, new, and we're conscious of this as a medium, but it's sort of a larger question of culture. And, you know, the damsels in distress wasn't invented by Nintendo with video games. It's just Nintendo.
Yeah, Sarkeesian pointed that out, that it goes, you know, as far as...
Way back.
Perseus.
Yes.
I hear there's a rumor that Pong was actually based around a game where you have to save your wife. Just a rumor. Josh, just a rumor.
Josh, the wife is the ball.
No. Selena. I imagine her name is Selena.
Getting back to the lazy writer's comment, you know, part of me views these tropes versus women critiques and thinks, yeah, you know, these representations are bad for women. But one can take a completely other perspective, which is like, how can we put up with the same stupid cliched plots in game after game after game? And, you know, I think the feminist critique, it's taking a look at games through a certain lens. But I think, you know, moving forward with the medium, we should look at games with a lot of different lenses and, you know, hold them up to a higher standard and expect a little more out of them, you know?
As a whole?
Yeah, I can totally, well, you know, games, we're going to diverse. I really think it's great that games will diversify and that we're actually going to be able to tackle more things. I still look at games and say that, you know, with movies, we've got a ton of different genres. I don't really see a lot of genres for games. There's action games, and then there's where's my romantic comedy, you know, sort of thing. And where's
if
my...
you want that, go for Sprung. That came out
oh,
with
I love
for...
Sprung! I love it!
Do you
oh
really?
My god! Yes!
That was my first game for the DS, and I beat it, like, 3 times.
Oh my god, it's so good. Anyone out there, track down a copy of Sprung. It was made by Ubisoft, but I think it had an American team writing it, and there was like
a bunch of soap opera writers.
It's awesome.
Maybe that's what the video game industry needs. more soap opera writers.
Well, I think the thing about a game like Sprung, and then even look at a game like Phoenix Wright, is...
Oh, Phoenix Wright. Oh my god, Phoenix Wright.
Is, you have to look at games, and we need to... I think Sarkeesian talks about this, too, in the second video. The problem is also impacted by the fact that a lot of games are only about violence, or, you know, committing, or they're action games, and you can only act through violence. Yeah. And that just shapes the entire thing. And actually, I was at E3 2006, and there was a panel with... I'm not sure if it was the panel with Cliffy B and the guy from Red Steel or Todd or someone from id, but I asked a question of, you know, we've talked about games for adults all this time, but why don't we actually see any, you know, more nuanced things? And they said, and basically the answer was, in these games, all players have is the gun. So they tried to put someone in there who gives you this whole backstory and dialogue and all this drama, but the players, their only recourse would be to try to shoot them in the face because that's the only thing they can do. And until we can make games that have different verbs in them, you know, the fact that we can only shoot people in the face as a form of expression is going to shape the stories.
correct me if I'm wrong, but you did respond to violence with violence in Phoenix Wright, at least for a few of them. You did kind of send people to die.
Yes, but your tool was not physical violence. It was
it was a thirst for revenge fueled by the blood of your enemies.
That's a motivation. That's a motivation. Not your action.
My weapon was revenge.
Your action was to, I don't know, I remember reading that actually Phoenix Wright only has two verbs. You can either basically trust somebody and say they're lying, or you can offer a contradictory piece of evidence. But
you
the game
also
uses
investigate.
Those two verbs. Well, investigate to find those pieces of evidence, those items.
And then send them to the gallows.
So I think the most violent thing you can do, well, the most violent personal action you can do is call them a liar.
Fair enough. I will back down.
Okay, but I think you were saying something, Julia?
Yeah, I was, so you talking about, you know, the kind of unrelenting violence in some of these games kind of reminded me, you know, there are ratings advisories and, you know, I think the Japanese government has taken measures to reduce violence in video games. And I think that's created social awareness in terms of, you know, these violent video games may have an impact on, you know, whoever's playing it at whatever age. But, you know, I think that the using the objectifying women in this way, you know, it would be nice to have, or in due course to have that kind of advisory as well. And in addition to these cautionary tales on violence in video games.
That's an interesting idea. So that sort of have that be part of the list of
things that are important. Yeah. You know, when you're emphasizing violence, you know, violence is something to be concerned about, you know, why not something like, you know, the treatment of women.
Mm-hmm. Or like very easily quantifiable things like contain scenes of, you know, graphic violence towards women, out of situation, suggestive dialogue, the sort of stuff TV has. Actually,
right,
TV
right.
sort of has. But, I mean, I just want to point out again that, you know, there's a lot of games that don't use violence, and I just want to see more of that. I mean, Animal Crossing, okay? You know, the most violent thing you can do there is...
How are you playing Animal Crossing? Because my town is painted red with the blood of my enemies that have wronged me. I'm probably not the greatest guy to ask about this topic of conversation, I'm realizing, as we get further into this.
Josh, I'm afraid of how you play Harvest Moon. Okay.
We're not going to get into that. We're not even going to get into that right now.
Luigi's Mansion is like you mentioned earlier, is a great example. That game just delighted me. I don't remember if Dream Team has another Princess Peach kidnapping as usual or not. In terms of Nintendo games kind of steering away from the trope.
Yeah, I think Don said that Peach does require rescuing
yeah.
at one point.
Okay. All right.
But wait, how about this? How about Fire Emblem games? They have been they're Nintendo owned and Nintendo run and all that Nintendo goodness, and I'm a huge fan of them. I've been playing them forever. And although there are like kidnappings, there's kidnappings of princes, princesses. It's not just one gender or the other. And for half the games, you play a woman general tactician, whatever you want to call it. Like the main character is a very strong female lead who needs no rescuing. Not even, and at the end, sometimes they rescue the prince. And they've been doing that for years and years. It just recently came over to America, so that's only when I started playing them. So I don't know, maybe I'm missing a few of them, but I wish I brought that up earlier. I'm sorry, I know that this is a calling back to like 15 minutes ago, to like the whole like Luigi's Mansion thing, but yes, Nintendo does have some other games. I'll be quiet now, sit in the corner.
It's just that, again, I want diversity of representation. I mean, just as someone who loves the video game medium, like I said before, I want my romantic comedies and my action movies, and I want everything in between. And if we do that, I think we'll go a long way towards showing a lot more different representations of women. I mean, I'm going to go out there and buy Bayonetta 2 for the Wii U, but I don't want that to be the only version of female characters out there. And I think that's what this boils down to again. It's just, sure, I don't I don't expect this trope to go away. In fact, I'm completely fine with Princess Peach getting kidnapped in, like, 80% of the games she's in. But that's just... But I want there to be other things going on, because I'm not... I don't want that to be the only example out there. I want, you know, complexity. And,
right.
And the problem, too, is that, you know, Luigi's been pushed in a corner all this time, too, just because he doesn't fit the typical example of your male hero, you know?
Yeah, he's not fat and short.
And he's afraid of spiders.
And I think Sarkeesian pointed out that, you know, this is as damaging to you know, these strict gender roles are as damaging to men, too, because now they only have one example of how they're supposed to act.
Right.
And, you know, one thing I love about Mario and Luigi is that, you know, they don't... I mean, I played Halo, but I don't want everyone to be Master Chief. You know, Mario's great, and he's just, like, this great mascot to have, and he's family-friendly, and I think he's unobjectionable.
Getting back to the diversity point, yes, there is a time and a place for the crude, unsophisticated male adolescent power fantasies, I think, as Sarkeesian puts it, right? But it's really just the preponderance of games and what writers keep falling back on. I know I said this before, but I just really want to reiterate the point. I don't think the criticism is, you know, to eliminate certain types of representations from media. It's just to make people mindful enough to, you know, start understanding why some of them are used so often and how those types of representations can be harmful to women. So I think, you know, one of the most disappointing things to me about this whole Women in Tropes series, project, whatever, is just the response of some of the people in our community to it, and just the really unnecessary level of defensiveness, you know. And I think it's important for people to realize that taking a critical look at something is not to completely devalue it, right? In fact, I think looking at something like gaming critically adds value. So people should think about that when, if somebody says something about something that they like that is critical, right? It's not because they don't want people to enjoy video games. It's because they probably themselves really enjoy video games and just want to make it better and to elevate it.
And I think that's what this kind of dialogue will do if it's taken in any meaningful way. I mean, is that everybody will benefit from shifts away from these kinds of stereotypes. And, you know, ideally it would make for a more diverse, you know, more dynamic, you know, just a much more inventive and fun, like, video game set.
It's just... I can completely agree with the people who find it, who find themselves feeling defensive. And it is uncomfortable to, like, watch these things and feel the criticism. And it's almost personal. But I feel like, you know, we have to head into that storm and we'll come out, video games will come out the other end stronger if we can actually face up to it and acknowledge the complexities. Because video games are getting more complex. And it's just going to be, I think that's just going to be a more wonderful thing.
I agree.
I agree.
Yes.
Okay, so here's looking forward to the next video in the series. And I do think there's a lot more talk about this in the industry. And I invite anyone in the forums to chime in on TalkBack. And maybe we'll continue it there. Okay, thanks everybody.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye. We'll be right back.
Hey, and welcome to what will likely be a recurring segment here on Connectivity. I'm Neil Ronahan, and with me is Scott Thompson.
Hello.
And I guess we don't really have a name for this yet, but I guess This Week in Nintendo might be something. Where
yeah, I like that.
We're going to record usually to focus on the downloads that came out that week, so they might be really short, depending on the amount of interesting and, you know, quantitative content that we get each week. This week is a pretty solid week for downloads, and we also had a Nintendo Direct, so we're going to cover that a little bit. But it wasn't really a groundbreaking Nintendo Direct, so we're just going to hit some of the things that at least we think are interesting. Before we dive into the stuff that I think is interesting, let's talk about what Nintendo thought was the most interesting and led with. Sonic Lost Worlds on Wii U and 3DS. There's going to be some sort of connectivity feature between the two systems, which is kind of neat. And then Rayman Legends on Wii U. Now, Scott, how do you feel about Lost World and Rayman Legends at this point?
Honestly, the most recent footage from Lost World got me to move from, like, absolutely don't care to, like, oh, okay, this doesn't look terrible. I still don't know that I don't know. You know, I've been burned by Sonic, I guess is what I'm trying to say here.
That's kind of what I'm at with Lost World, because I was, when I first saw it, I'm like, wow, it seems like they finally figured this shit out. And then I played it at E3 and was really underwhelmed. I seem to be in the minority, though, because a lot of people are kind of apeshit over it, even people who played the E3 demo.
Yeah.
But for me, I mean, it just kind of felt like tired, the same old bullshit with a slightly different color. It's like, this time, he's wearing a blue hat instead of a red one. Like, that's kind of what it felt like to me.
Yeah.
Is like, now you're playing behind the back and you can rotate around this tube. And I'm like, cool, it still controls pretty awkwardly, and starting and stopping isn't really that nice.
Yeah, that's I've never really been big into the 3D Sonic games. Yeah. I think like the Sonic Rush series on DS was really great, and then sort of the prequels to those, the Sonic the Hedgehog games that came out on Game Boy Advance, were really great. Yeah. And then I even really enjoyed the recent Sonic like XBLA game.
Oh, Sonic the Hedgehog 4?
Yeah, and then parts what 1 and 2? I think they did a 3.
They cut it off after that.
Even those were pretty solid, but the 3D stuff just doesn't really appeal to me, because it is a lot of just like running really fast in a straight line, and then anytime you have to like stop, it becomes terrible.
Yeah, and that's what I missed at E3 was the 3DS version of Lost World, but even that's a 3D Sonic game as far as I know. It's not that that's not appealing to me, but that's one that I need to like get my hands on before I fully judge it. But the Wii U one, I'm not really that interested in. That could change if people seem to be really digging it, and maybe I play it and see it in a different light, but as of now, I'm not too excited for Lost World.
Yeah, hopefully there'll be a demo. They did a demo for Sonic Racing, so hopefully Sega will keep that up. But, you know, if I get sold on a demo, maybe I'll eventually check it out. But, I'm still on the fence about that one. But, and then we got Rayman, which, you know, we've seen promoted now for over a year and should have already been out half a year ago.
Yeah.
And
now I know you've always been one of the people that's been really big on Rayman Legends.
I am.
From the demos and everything. Are you still signing up day one, getting this on Wii U?
I will, yeah. I'm trying to act like tough and angry and angsty, but I'll still end up buying it on day one. I really love Origins, and I the challenge app has been great, and I'm just a big fan. I like the new rhythm levels and everything, so there's no way I won't be getting it. And it's a fun game for Tabby and I to play together.
Now, yeah, because we were talking about this right before the show when I mentioned that I think if I get this game, I'll probably get the Vita version.
Yeah.
Because I'll probably only play it as a single-player experience, and that version will be cheaper than other versions. And from what I've only played the demo of Rayman Origins on Vita, and I'm kind of thinking about the $6.75 deal that's going on the PSN with PS Plus and everything this week. But I really like the way that game feels on Vita, and I think playing Legends on Vita might be the way to go. Now, for you with Wii U, like, what's keeping you to that instead of like going to 360 or PS3 or Vita? Well, you don't have a Vita, so that answers that one.
I don't play 360. I have one, but I don't play it because I don't want to pay for gold. And then my PS3 is broken. So, like, by default, I have to do Wii U. But I would still do Wii U anyway, because that's kind of where I'm trying to focus most of my gaming time, I guess you could say. Even though there's no, like, online mode or something, I don't know. There's something about having an HD Nintendo console now that it's like, I don't want to just you know, I don't want to take that for granted.
And also, off-TV play is
exactly,
still a hell of a thing.
And, you know, I just am comfortable doing my gaming there. And that's, I've added, like, I mean, my friends list is full of people from NWR and stuff. And, you know, it's just where I am most comfortable playing games that are available on everything. But for your case, I mean, with having a Vita and not probably playing much multiplayer at all, like, this is a great game to have on the go. I mean, a challenging 2D platformer that you can just, like, jump in and play a level and then jump out.
And I hope, and maybe the Vita, I haven't followed up too much on it, but the Vita might even have the touchscreen stuff that's in the Wii U version, which would be pretty sweet. I'm still kind of, I don't really understand how they're going to take all the, like, the Murphy stuff from Rayman Legends and make that even work on 360 and PS3. I'm really curious, because I just don't know, unless they're going to use tablet support. Once again, I haven't kept up with it on any other system other than Wii U, so I don't know for sure. But anyway, let's move on to some other stuff from the Nintendo Direct. What I thought was really cool, even though I realized when I started to get pissy that Professor Layton and the Azran Legacy, the sixth Layton game, it's coming out in Europe in November. It's already, it came out in Japan earlier this year, and it's coming out in North America in 2014. Regardless, I think it's the quickest translation time for a Layton game ever. And, I mean, it's the kind of thing where before I get pissy about the European version coming out first, I need to take a step back and realize that I still haven't beaten Miracle Mask, so maybe I should beat that and then complain. But maybe next week I'll be all pissed off and be like, well, I beat Miracle Mask now, where's the next one?
Yeah. It's weird. I mean, I understand that's a text-heavy game, so translating it from Japanese to English is one thing, but there's no excuse to not release it in Europe and America at the same time.
Yeah, but I mean, we'll see. Maybe North America will get some bone thrown our way. Who knows?
Well, the thing is now, like, we're so behind that if they were to catch up, they'd have to put out, like, two Layton games in the same year, and maybe that's the problem, is now that they're behind, they don't want to, like, flood us with Layton games.
Well, I mean, now, when the sixth one comes out, then we'll be caught up, and then we did find out that Professor Layton versus Ace Attorney is coming out in 2014 as well.
Mm-hmm.
And with those two releases, that means we will be on the same page as Japan, barring no announcement of a new Layton game in the next 6 months.
That's the big thing.
Although I'm pretty sure that Level 5, at least right now, they're not working on a Layton game. I think they've, like, Akira Hino has said as much in recent times about how I think he wants to go back to the series, but they haven't done it yet. So I think we might have a little while. But either way, I'm really excited for both Layton 6 and Professor Layton versus Ace Attorney, because the trailer that they showed for Layton versus Ace Attorney just looks super fucking ridiculous.
Just crazy, right?
And I remember hearing some of the buzz on that from the Japanese version was that, you know, it's kind of a little janky because the two gameplay styles don't totally add up. But for me, that's just one of those, like, Tatsunoko versus Capcom insane things that, like, even if it fails a little bit, it's still going to be really cool to see. Or even Project Cross Zone is probably a better example, where it's just this mishmash of characters and worlds that might have some faults, but just seeing it all put together is a unique thing.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I'm really excited. I love this kind of crossover stuff, as long as it's at least somewhat playable. This will be that. So, and I'm surprised that it's coming here. Do we know... I know the thought was that it was just going to be a digital release. Do we know if that's still the case?
I don't think anything's confirmed, although I do think Level 5 is publishing it. That's what I've heard regarding that. So it's not Capcom, and I don't know if Level 5... Well, yeah, I mean, it could be outside of the Guild Zero 2 games, or the Guild games in general. No, it's the only stuff Level 5 has published in North America. This might just be a digital release, but we don't know for sure.
Yeah.
And I think we won't find out until Level 5 says as much. The other thing that I just want to point out is The Legend of Zelda: A Link Between Worlds is so fucking cool.
So good.
Yeah, like, the more they show me of that game, the more I just want it, like, directly into my veins right now.
I'm so excited. This is probably going to be... I mean, Skyward Sword was really, really... I mean, it was really great. I love Skyward Sword, but this will probably be the best Zelda game in a long time. Best handheld Zelda game. For sure.
That I don't think is really that difficult.
Yeah.
Considering that Spirit Tracks is pretty solid. Don't get me wrong. I wasn't a big fan of Phantom Hourglass. Minish Cap is okay. And I'm only playing the Oracle games now, so.
And they're fine, yeah. Probably the greatest is probably Link's the first. Awakening. Yeah. So this will be exciting. I'm really looking forward to this. And fingers crossed that they'll put out A Link to the Past on 3DS or Wii U before this comes out, because I'd love to revisit it. Like you, like we were talking about on Twitter, in a legal manner.
Yep. Well, I mean, you can play it on Wii Virtual Console, and I have it on Super Nintendo still, but, I mean, there's something about playing it on Wii U would be way easier.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm all for convenience in this day and age. Yeah, right. Probably, I don't know why I keep my video game collection then, if I'm just like, I could break out the Super Nintendo, or I could just fucking buy it.
Spend $9 and download it, yeah.
And then the last thing from the Nintendo Direct that I thought was interesting was the Virtual Console games that were announced. Summer Carnival 92 Rekka, which is a super hard-to-find Japanese-only Famicom release. I think it came out, it came out in 1992, like the fucking name says.
Yeah, right. Between Earthbound and this, do you think, like, Nintendo's just trying to actively fuck with, like the used games market?
I really hope so.
Like, are they going to, next week, they're going to announce, like, the, what was it called? Like, the Nintendo World Championship.
That, I mean, in all honesty, there's no doubt in my mind. I think we'll probably get those on Virtual Console within the next year or two.
Isn't that crazy? It just feels like an active motive now.
I mean, that's pretty cool. I think I might pick that up just for the novelty factor, but it doesn't really sound like something I give a shit about, because it's just a really hard shmup.
Right, and, like, given, like, how much stuff is already out on the Japanese Virtual Console that should come to America, like, what a weird thing to focus on and highlight in a direct, nonetheless. I mean, it's just so bizarre.
But then we found out that Tecmo Bowl is coming over, which, that's kind of weird. I believe that the Tecmo Bowl on NES came out on Wii Virtual Console.
I think so.
I should probably fact-check this. Yeah, the 2007 Virtual Console release is a modified version of the game without the NFLPA license, since EA owns exclusive rights to it. Thus, the players are represented only by number and not by name. So who the fuck cares?
Yeah, and that's probably what's going to happen again.
Yeah, because this looks like it's the same NES version coming to Wii Virtual Console. And I love Tecmo Bowl, but if I can't play Bo Jackson, who gives a rat's ass? Or if I can't, I oddly like the Chicago Bears in the original Tecmo Bowl, because they only really? Had like 12 teams. That was mainly because I thought, I mean, I've always liked Walter Payton just because he's an awesome player.
Yeah.
And while Bo Jackson was a superhuman robot, Walter Payton was also very good. And I think he played as Jim McMahon, who I think when I first played Tecmo Bowl, that's when he was a backup on the Packers in the mid-90s.
Oh, so there you go.
And also I couldn't play as a Packer, so I had to pick a team to play as.
Fun connectivity factoid. I gave a copy of Tecmo Bowl away during PAX when we did Jeopardy.
Would you look at that?
That was one of our, like, if a person in the audience got a question right, we gave him an NES cartridge. And on the back, I just wrote Bo Jackson in all capital letters. So, like, probably a couple exclamation points.
That's what you do when that happens. Yep.
If you're out there and you got that cartridge, email me.
Yeah, that'd be fun. Donkey Kong NES, who gives a fuck?
Nope.
How many versions of Donkey Kong do I have at this point? I didn't even get the 30-cent version on Wii U.
I was just going to say, and they were just signed up for 30, and now this is going to be like $6 on 3DS.
I'd rather get the arcade version, honestly. Like, that's more interesting to me.
Mm-hmm.
Wario Land 3, though, that seems pretty awesome. That's one of those games that I've never really played, so I'm excited for that to come in a way that I can play on my 3DS legally. I'm super excited for that. It's just that it came out about 8 months after every other region got it.
Mm-hmm.
And then Super Mario Bros. 3 in this week in big fucking surprise news, right next to Luigi and Smash Brothers, Super Mario Bros. 3 will be coming to the Wii U and 3DS Virtual Console sometime soon.
Yay. Now, this is interesting, I think, just because it's the first time they've announced a Virtual Console game to be hitting both platforms. Not necessarily, like, same day, they didn't say, but they just announced it coming to both for sure, which is kind of interesting. But will it mean cross-platform play? Buy it on one, play on the other? Probably not.
Yeah,
great.
I mean, well, I still think what Nintendo, not necessarily what they should do, because, of course, in a perfect world, I would like to see them do what Sony's doing with Vita and PS3, where it's just cross-buy. I think what they will do, and what I hope they do, like, this year, is have it where, like, you buy, you know, like, let's say you buy Super Mario Bros. 3 on Wii U for $5, then for $1, you can upgrade to have it on your 3DS. And, like, you know, that the same thing for the conversion rate for Super Nintendo games would also work. You know, whatever, like, maybe for N64 games, unfortunately, it's $2 to make it work on your 3DS or something, but...
Yeah.
I mean, that seems like a solution that will let Nintendo still be a little money grubbing, but make it make more sense, because I can say for this much, like, I'll probably, like, I got Super Mario Bros. 2 upgraded on my Wii U. I don't want to buy it again on 3DS for $5. But if you said, oh, you can play it on your 3DS if you pay $1, I'd do that.
Right. Yeah, that's, and if they're going to do it in any way, that'd probably be how they do it. They're not going to give it away for free, probably.
Very true.
If they do it at all, I could easily see it being just available on both, and you have to pay regardless.
They could totally get away with that, unfortunately.
Yeah.
At least for now. So let's move on to This Week in Downloads. This is probably what the segment will be more often, is none of that Nintendo Direct funny stuff in the beginning. You can check out the Nintendo Downloads in article form on the website. Justin Baker, as usual, wrote up a banging recommendation of what you should check out on the downloads. Talking about Smash Bowling and SteamWorld Dig and Mario and Luigi Dream Team and all that jazz. But we're just going to tackle this from the top and work our way down. First up, we got a sale for Escape Vector for $4.99. That's in effect until 2 weeks from now, August 22nd. I really enjoyed the game. I believe I reviewed it. I'm not 100% sure on this. I've had a busy life lately, so there have been like the RFN poll, Pandora's Tower one, and I reviewed that game like 4 months ago. And it was one of those things where I'm like, fuck, what was that game like? And then I had to reread my review, and then it came back to me. But there was a minute there where I'm like, I literally spent like 15 hours in this game like 4 months ago, and I can't really remember that many specifics about it. I've got a lot of shit going on. But yeah, Escape Vector, pretty cool game. I think it's a little long in the tooth, but that's not necessarily a bad thing when you're spending $5 on a game.
Yeah.
There's a shit ton of content in it, but I found it pretty addicting. It's like a weird Pac-Man style game. And, you know, you try to set a fast time on a stage and stuff like that and find the optimal route through it. I had a lot of fun with it. Have you checked it out at all, Scott?
No,
I haven't.
Do you know
what this game is?
Yeah, I've seen, like, screenshots and stuff, and I kind of thought about getting it in the past, so maybe the sale will get me to do that. I don't know. But there's a lot of great stuff this week, too, so
yeah.
Probably won't bite on this right away.
Yeah, Mario & Luigi Dream Team is coming out on Sunday, on August 11th. You know, we're back up to that full price window, or the $39.99 price for Nintendo-published 3DS games. It was weird because Donkey Kong Country Returns and Animal Crossing were both $35, both at retail and on the eShop.
Really weird for Animal Crossing. Donkey Kong, it's like a re-release of a Wii game, but yeah. Animal Crossing is a full brand new game.
It was just a really weird experimentation, I felt, where they made the games $35. And I mean, both of those games sold really well, though I think that has nothing to do with the price.
No.
So next down, we've got Smash Bowling 3D. That's $4.99, and it's from Big John Games. They're generally good people. We've had a long-standing relationship with them as far as talking to them about stuff. They did this cool DSiWare game, Thorium Wars, which is supposed to be a retail game. But Smash Bowling 3D is a bowling game on the 3DS. Yeah, that's about it. You can do four-player multiplayer using one system where, you know, you bowl, and then you pass it to your friend, and you bowl, and then that guy passes to another friend, and then he bowls.
Yeah.
You do that. I mean, and that seems kind of fun, because I played a shit ton of mixed messages. I think I still have, even on my 3DS, played some mixed messages from time to time when, like, waiting for a movie to start with friends.
Is that the one where you, like, it gives you something to draw?
Yeah, it's a game of telephone.
Oh, man, that is really good.
Yeah, and I mean, for this being a kind of past the system game, you know, having a bowling game like that, that actually doesn't sound too bad.
Mm-mm.
I mean, especially after seeing, what's the name of the game? We talked about it on the Vita segment that you will hear next week. Frobisher Says, when we played a ton of that.
Oh,
Pax East,
yeah.
Just having that good portable game that you can just pass around and kind of play multiplayer as you go. This could fit into that hole. We have Becky Holliday is on the review, so we should hear more about her thoughts about the game very soon. Next up, we got SteamWorld Dig from Image and Form. That is $8.99, and this is getting an amazing amount of
praise
right now.
Yeah, it's like blown up today.
Yeah, I mean, we've had a couple interviews with these guys. I think, well, on this very episode isn't
you'll hear Don's,
Don. Yeah, Don interviewing. Not even going to try to pronounce his name. One of the dudes from Image and Form.
Well, his first name is pronounced Brian, even though it's spelled, like, with a J
okay.
and some other letters thrown in there. But it's Don told me it's pronounced Brian.
Okay, yeah. So Brian from Image and Form, they're Swedish dudes. They're super cool. We did an interview with them, an email interview that you can check up on the site. It's from, I think, a month or so ago. It was when I think they talked about the release date of this game, which was kind of unassuming, but it seems like people love the shit out of this game so far. It's like a mining Metroid game, it seems.
Yeah, Don gave it a 9, and then, just as people started downloading it today, I mean, they're going crazy for it on Twitter.
Yeah, my roommate downloaded it, and he's liked what he's played so far.
Yeah.
It's digging, and it's like a Metroidvania, and it looks really nice, too. It's like a sequel to a tower defense game, in which, like, the tower defense game was, like, these robots fighting against humans, and then the robots won, and now this is that future. Which also, like, I like that setup, too. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, that is actually kind of unique.
Yeah. And then Tangram Style is $6.99. And actually, on Nintendo's website, it doesn't list who the publisher is. I think I might be able to find this up because someone was contacting them about getting a review code. Have you ever heard of Tangrams?
No, I haven't. Although looking at the write-up that Justin did, as he describes them, it sounds familiar.
It's basically like these, I think I've seen them as like block puzzles before, but it's like these, you know, different like geometric shapes that then like you need to fit them into to make another shape.
Mm-hmm.
At least that's what this game is. And it's from Moving Player. They're an indie studio based in the French Riviera. Seems like a cool place to be based in. And we should have a review up on that soon. We don't have anybody on the docket to review that yet. We're still waiting on a review code for it. But it might be cool. It might be a cool time waster. There's 600 puzzles in it, so
wow. That
could be nice. Now we're getting to, I don't know if these are slightly more exciting, but DuckTales Remastered is hell of exciting, but that's not out until next Tuesday, August 13th.
Right.
It's $14.99. I'll be getting this game day one, but once again, the big question is, what system, Scott?
Wait, what system to get it on?
Yeah.
I'd do Wii U.
Yeah, I think I'm doing Wii U, the off-TV play, and also they have a map on the gamepad, and seems nice to have as well. But I do like how Justin does point out that you should just buy and listen to the music because it's already a great soundtrack, and then you have Vert from Way Forward doing the music for it, which, from what I've heard of his music for DuckTales, it sounds incredible.
Yeah.
And also that game's hella cool.
Yeah, I'm really, really excited for this. I'm worried, though, because as is the case with a lot of these old classic games that kind of get, like, new HD releases, you kind of find that with sort of, like, I don't know. You're
like
able
Castle
to blow through a lot. No, well, maybe.
Well, that's actually what I found, because I played both this and Castle of Illusion, which, for some fucked up reason, isn't coming to Wii U.
Yeah.
And I think I don't even think that's out yet. I think that's out later in the month.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure.
But Castle of Illusion, playing that over at Sega's booth at E3, I found I really didn't like what they did with the HD remake and how that game felt. Whereas with DuckTales, like, the game still felt fantastic.
Yeah.
I think that DuckTales probably holds up better than Castle Lake.
Yeah. I guess, too, I'm thinking of, like, some of the beat-em-ups where, you know, like, the Simpsons arcade game where it's, like, you have these fond memories of it, but once you remove, like, the penalty of having to pay quarters to keep playing, it kind of loses some of its charm, you know? Like, it's just not as difficult, and I don't know...
Yeah.
Do you know if DuckTales, like, I mean, is it infinite continues? You just keep going till you're done?
Honestly, it's been a while since I played the NES game, and I was even a latecomer to the NES game. I bought the NES game, I think, for, like, $5, like, 3 years ago, something like that. And that was the first time I ever really played it. It was just, like, that was not the Disney game that I played in my youth. I played a shit ton of Quackshot.
I was a big Chip and Dale... Rescue
yeah,
Rangers.
Yeah, Chip and Dale was a game that I played as a kid.
Yeah. I played this as a kid, but I just don't really remember. But thinking of it as a classic NES game, I feel like I'm sure there were continues and you could just eventually game over. And I don't know if in this remastered version, if that's still in place, if they've removed that, if it's an option. But I find once that penalty's not there and you can just play straight through, they kind of lose some of their charm because they're just not as challenging. But we'll see.
Yeah.
I'm excited either way.
Yep, yep.
Did you see the gold cartridges they got mailed out?
Yeah, those
people?
Are super cool.
Awesome.
The next Wii U eShop game is Spin the Bottle Bumpy's Party, which is $8.99 for now. This game has kind of an interesting pricing structure. It's from Napnock Games. I forget. They're from Europe. I forget which country. I want to say the Netherlands, but I'm not entirely sure.
Yeah.
Once again, Don did an interview with these guys on last week's episode of Connectivity, and he also has the review up, in which he really dug the game, I know.
Yeah, he gave it an 8.
Cool. but this is the kind of game that, to me, I will likely buy. Because I know that there will be a chance where I am drinking and the Wii U is near me and I will play this game and I will force my friends to do stupid things with a Wii remote. Because you don't even need to use the TV. It's all on the gamepad. I know, I was talking to, the guy who worked on this at E3, and I think if you have the TV on, it'll have like ambient music, but for the most part, you just use the gamepad and it spins the bottle, so to speak. And then it'll, you know, pick a person and then pick a random person to do, like, a challenge with them. And Guillaume and I actually played this at E3. Jared taped it, but apparently it didn't come out that good. But we had to do stuff like we would be on our knees with our backs between each other, with our backs between each other, or back to back on our knees, and we'd have to hold the Wii remotes between our legs and act like we're sawing, but we'd have to do it in tandem. So that way we'd actually get it right. There was another one where we had to stand up and be back to back and then pass the Wii remote in a circle, but we had to do it without waking the badger, which was the Wii remote. So like we couldn't shake the Wii remote a lot or else the badger would wake up and we'd lose.
Yeah.
And basically like you get different points for completing things, and the cool thing about it is that you're not really going to get into that situation where, you have two people working together, and if you win, oh, then that one person's going to get their last point and they're going to win, because whoever's on the winning team, when someone wins, they both win. So, but what happens with this game is that, the developer is going to keep on adding more games to it. It's got 17 at launch and it's going to be $9. And they're going to add more games to it and raise the price each time they add more games to it. So, it's an interesting pricing scheme, because if you buy it for $9 right now, then you'll get every game that ever comes to the game. However, if you wait and, like, you know, they add a couple games and raise it up to, like, 10 or 11 bucks, then you'd have to buy it for that if you want to get the game. But, I mean, it definitely sounds like if you're going to have some friends over, maybe you're tired of Nintendo Land, maybe you just all hate TVs, then Spin the Bottle might be a really fun game to get.
Yeah, I'm really excited. I think this will be a fun party game for sure, and I'm going to download it. And see, that's the kind of thing, I don't know if I should just buy it now, even though I don't know when anything will come up that I'll actually use it, or risk paying more later. I don't know.
Yeah, I think I might end up getting it this weekend. It'll probably be like, oh, we're going to have a few friends over tonight? I know what I'm getting.
Yeah, exactly.
But yeah, I look forward to playing this at PAX East, honestly.
Yes. Yeah.
I look forward to playing a lot of Wii U stuff at PAX East next year. But the last game on the list is a Wii U Virtual Console game, Romance of the Three Kingdoms 4, Wall of Fire. It's available for $8. And despite the fact that I don't ever remember this game coming out on the Wii Virtual Console, it did.
Yeah, it's a Sega Genesis game, right?
No, it's a Super Nintendo game.
Is it a Super? Wow, okay.
Yeah, I think there was a Romance of the Three Kingdoms at Sega Genesis. Was there? Quote me on that. But I also know this version came out on PC, the Saturn, the Dreamcast, most of these only in Japan, the 32X, the PlayStation. Wow. So it got around. And this was, I think, 1995 was when it came out. But, I mean, it's a turn-based strategy game. It takes place in China during the Second Han Dynasty. But yeah, I mean, I've never really played a Romance of the Three Kingdoms game, so I can't really say what it's like. But I think it's, you know, it's in that similar vein of a Fire Emblem or a Shining Force.
Yeah,
so if that's your bag, you might want to check it out. And if you found out to your surprise that you had this on Wii, you can upgrade it for $1.50.
Well, there you go. What a weird addition to the Wii U Virtual Console.
Like Secret of Mana? Nah.
Yeah, Chrono Trigger, Final Fantasy VI. I mean, anything.
Yeah.
Any Mario game. Just like, no, let's throw Romance of the Three Kingdoms on there.
Yeah.
Why not?
All right, well, I think that's it for this this week in Nintendo news. Maybe we'll come up with a better name. Maybe this will just be our own Nintendo Direct. Who knows?
Connectivity Direct.
Yes, a Connectivity Direct, and then we have to do the little sign. Maybe it'll just be like two middle fingers instead of doing the little direct sign that he wanted.
Yeah, us. I like it.
All right. Well, hope you enjoyed, and if you have any questions, be sure to call us. Call us. Email us. Call us at 1-800 two middle fingers. No. Be sure to email us at connectivity@nintendoreport.com. You can also hit me up on Twitter at @Enron10, and you can hit up Scott on Twitter at @OKSoda.
That's right.
Yeah. I hope you enjoyed, and give us feedback, because that's the only way we'll learn.
It's true.
Bye.
Bye.
Hello everyone, and welcome to another eShop interview here on Nintendo World Report. My name is Dan Koopman, and I am here with Brian.
Hi. How are you doing?
I'm pretty good, thank you. Bit of a ramshackle start. We had to cover out some things, but now we're kicking live here with an interview. Could you kick things off by talking a bit about yourself?
Well, sure, I can do that. So, I'm Brian Sigurgesson, and I run Image and Form. It's a game dev studio in Gothenburg, Sweden. Mm-hmm. And there's 11 of us now. It's actually the biggest we've ever been. As all studios, I think you run an amoeba kind of lifestyle. You grow, and then you shrink a little bit, and then you grow again. And right now we're on the rise, so we just want to ride the wave. We've been in business since 1997, but we haven't gone into game development only until 2004. And that's when we got started doing a lot of Mac and PC games, play and learn games for kids. Mm-hmm. And then after that, in around 2009 or so, we decided to move into iOS development, and we made a couple of questionable games for iOS, and then we made a really great game for iOS called Ant Hill. Ant Hill was a major success for us, both critically and economically. Mm-hmm. And now we are doing a game for the Nintendo 3DS instead. So it's quite a leap for us. But I'm sure you'll ask me about that later.
Of course I will. For you have also made, your company has also made, like, in the same series, like a DSiWare title, because I believe, because the SteamWorld thing didn't came just pulled out of a hat. It started as a title called, I believe, SteamWorld Tower Defense, which was released roughly 3 years ago.
Yeah, that's right. We released SteamWorld Tower Defense just because at that point in 2010 when we released that game.
Yeah.
We were just leaving a very comfortable sort of work for hire production studio phase, where we had done all these kids games, and we had tried and failed with a few early iOS games, and then we got a very talented programmer on board who had done Nintendo DS games before, and we wanted to check out the DSiWare store. And so we made this tower defense game with a twist where it's humans versus robots, but mm-hmm. but the twist is that you play the nice and friendly robots against the greedy, sort of depraved looking humans. And so that was the it actually caught a little bit of attention, but we were very much rookies at the time when it comes to PR and marketing.
Yes.
Because we had had such a comfortable ride up until then. And so we did a bare minimum of PR. We sent out for reviews to, I think, 3 or 4 places. And amazingly, the game paid for itself.
Yeah.
And it was a huge surprise to us because we realized that the DSiWare store was a quite horrible marketplace. It was really hard to find games, and but people found it and it paid for itself.
Well,
and so
yeah, I believe that IGN did a review of it. I mean, currently the maker of that review, Lucas M. Thomas, is my boss at like Nintendo Force Magazine, and he worked like all that DSiWare stuff back in the day, and.
Yeah.
It's what my soul me back in that back in the day on most of that DSiWare games as well. So, in that fashion, that was kind of the amazing point for you guys that IGN saw that game and thought, let's publish a review, and everybody saw it.
Yeah, I don't know if you've been talking to Lucas about these last few days, but we actually got an email from Lucas, and I had to write back immediately and say, you know, thanks. If it weren't for you, I mean, we wouldn't have made SteamWorld Dig, which we're putting out now, because if he hadn't published that review, that game wouldn't have, we would have lost money making it, and we probably would just have scrapped the idea of going with Nintendo. So, Lucas Thomas, wherever you are, we love you to bits.
I will send him a mail with this interview, possibly, like 2 days later.
Okay.
What made you so look back on that game so fondly and made you go back to that universe? Because it has been a gap between those two games, of course.
Oh, it has. for us, it's been... So we made that game in 2010. And then when we had finished that game, we got a grant for making Antil for iOS. Mm-hmm. And that sort of put us in a difficult spot because we had gotten money to develop it, so we thought that okay, we have to develop that game, and so we made Antil, and very soon it turned out to be a sort of a hit gameplay, and so we developed that, and that was a success. After Antil, we went back to do a little bit of work for hire, mm-hmm. because we tried out some prototypes for other iOS games that we had lying around, or ideas that we had lying around.
Yeah.
And the prototypes weren't that satisfying. Hmm. And so we were thinking, okay, isn't it time then to revisit SteamWorld and to expand on that story? Hmm. Because in the beginning, when we made SteamWorld, we thought, yeah, that's a nice twist. But towards the end of making SteamWorld Tower Defense, we thought, how did this world come about? Why is it the way it is? What is the background story? And we sort of thought, okay, what must have happened for this world to exist the way it is? Why are the humans the lowlives? And why are the robots the friendly guys? It's always the other way around.
I think even in the PR, you called it hobos, I believe.
Yeah. Yes. Well, it's rude. And I apologize to all hobos out there, okay? But the thing that we thought up was that what if Charles Babbage, the inventor and scientist in the 19th century, I mean in 18-something, mm-hmm. he was working on a mechanical computer, and he succeeded to a certain extent. But what if he had succeeded all the way in making a computer 100 years before the actual first computers were made, mm-hmm. and at that, how would he have done it at that time? Well, obviously he would have to do something steam driven. You didn't have electricity, and if he had managed making mechanical computers that way, well, the step going from there to making robots is not that huge. Mm-hmm. Okay, so he managed to make robots that do all the menial tasks. What will happen to the world? Okay, our idea was that humanity would be lazy and depraved, and also the robots would happily go about doing all the things that they were programmed for.
Yeah.
But there would be one more thing that these guys in the 19th century wouldn't have foreseen, and that's weapons technology would have accelerated much, much faster. If you would have mechanical computers, the accuracy of all your cannons and so on would have gone up amazingly. And that means that you could have full-scale world wars at that point in time. And that, in SteamWorld, that is exactly what has happened. Everybody copies everybody else's technology, and then you have bigger wars than you're really prepared to have. And you have bad communications, so you can't really negotiate over the phone. And so humanity blows itself to bits, more or less. And the parts that are untouched after a big war like this is exactly hobo land, where nobody was. So a few hobos that have no intention of running the world, they're still around.
Yes.
But the robots who are doing all the menial tasks, they're actually the ones who are getting the day-to-day business done.
Yeah. So now that you are back to that franchise and you are releasing to the world SteamWorld Dig, so the war against the humans is now over and you're now trying to explore mines for yourself. In a few words, how can you describe like the game the best?
I'd say it's a game with a story-driven mining platformer. So it's a story-driven mining platform adventure is what we call it. It's what you do in the game is you mine.
Yes.
Most of the game takes place inside a mine, and it's a 2D game, so you see it from the side. It's like someone just cut a slice and you're looking at what Rusty, the main character, is doing underground.
Yes.
So that's what you do. You mine, you bring up the loot to the surface, and you sell it to the shops, and you get money to buy upgrades, better pickaxes, other tools, so you can go further down. And we also call it a platform game because the controls in the game are very much that of a platform game. So you use any console would lend itself perfectly to SteamWorld Dig. It has really neat platform controls. But it's also an adventure. It starts out at one distinct point, and it ends at a distinct point many hours later.
Yes.
And in between there, you have an escalating storyline. In the beginning, the game is soft-paced and friendly, and as you start out, and then you find more and more disturbing things underground until the climactic showdown at the end. So it's in that sense, it's a classic game.
Yeah.
It is finite. You have a beginning, you have an end, and hopefully there's a lot of juicy stuff in the middle.
That's always important. Towards the beginning, towards the end, always a goal to go through. Talking about goals, then, your main objective is mine, sell and see the town of, like, I think it's called Tumbleton?
Yep.
Yeah, Tumbleton, like, go to bigger glory. Like, how will the game progress, and how will you keep it fresh, like, through its running time?
Well, the thing is that we were concerned in the beginning of two things, or it's mainly balancing things, but it made us change the gameplay as well. It was how do we make sure that people don't get bored in playing it, because mining is, in essence, it's grinding. You go down, you pick up loot, you go to the surface, you sell it, you get better stuff, you go down again and mine and so on. How do you prevent that from getting boring? And on the other end of that spectrum, how do you prevent people from getting through the game too quickly? And that sounds harsh, but how do you keep people occupied the whole time?
Yeah.
And so it's, the game is, it's mission driven that way. So you're told from the beginning by the friendly people in Tumbleton up on the surface what you're supposed to do at first, and then you sort of find your way down there. And then these hints get fewer and more far between, and you sort of have to figure out for yourself what to do and where to go.
Yeah.
And there's a multitude of caves in the game that you go to pick up serious upgrades and so on.
Yes.
And those, and there are really no clues of how you're going to puzzle your way through those caves. Some are very simple, and some are a bitch. Yep.
Well, that's a perfect way of describing it, I guess. So what I found in the game, because I played it a bit for the people not in the know, because we haven't mentioned it since the beginning, I'm sorry. The game seems quite focused on your resources. So I played through some elements of it, and I found that I had to keep a lot of things in check. So will you be able to upgrade all your equipment in due course, or are there still like some restrictions to it later on?
Well, it's all your equipment is upgradable. So all the things that you carry with you, and it's from the beginning, it's not very much. I mean, you go down there with a pretty blunt pickaxe and a very small knapsack on your back, and it fills up very quickly. And then one of the other elements in the game is lighting. When you go down underground, since you're a steam-driven robot, the light will dwindle as your coal dwindles. You use it up. So SteamWorld Dig has that, that if you play the game and somebody calls you on the phone and you take that call and and while away a few minutes, then when you return to the game, it's actually, if you're underground, it's actually quite dark, and you won't be able to see the resources around you, and you sort of have to guess your way up again, and when you get to the surface, you get light. So all of the resources in the game can be upgraded. And it's, I would, for myself, when I've played through it, I've played through in a dozen of different ways. I've tried collecting everything and to find as much as possible. And I've also tried to just speed run down, basically just trying to drill a vertical shaft to go.
Did that go well?
No. You have to sort of pace yourself because, well, for one thing, you can't really do that because your equipment won't beat the tougher soil. The soil gets tougher,
yes,
as you go down.
Yeah.
But it also, I mean, I've found that once you've played it fully once, where you've explored everything and you found all the caves and all the orbs that you want to collect and so on, then
yeah,
the second time, I bet you want to try to see how fast you can get down, and also how skillfully you can play, meaning not only how fast you can go, but also how can you keep your number of deaths to a minimum and so on. There are quite a few ways to play this game.
Yeah.
And I think it has pretty excellent replayability value.
We'll get to that a little later. But just because our main character is more friendly, it doesn't mean that the adventure could severely damage in Iraq, and we talked about deaths already a little bit. What are some of like the obstacles that Rusty will encounter on a strip, and are there like large punishments for not being careful?
Oh, there are some pretty evil punishments. Yes. For one, I don't know how much I should spoil, but there are, let's call them just different types of enemies.
Yeah.
And there's quite a number of those. Mm-hmm. But then there's also environmental hazards.
Yep.
As you go down, you will run into a lot of nastiness if you're not careful. Mm. There just lots of things with the ground that will will try to screw you over. Mm-hmm. For example, you have spike traps. For some reason, there are spike traps in the underground. And then you have layers of acidic earth, which is very tricky to get past.
Yeah. I mean, in the early stages, I came across those spike traps, and I quickly found my first upgrade, which were, I think, the running shoes, or the ability to run. And those were a pretty help, because those blocks, disappear in an instant. So it becomes you already get an idea of the dangers you are ahead of you pretty quick.
Right. And it's also, always a balance issue in games, but here it's been that we want you to find the upgrade that you need to sort of get past the next point. Mm-hmm. And chances are that you will find the upgrades. It gets trickier and trickier to get to them as you progress through the game. So, but yeah, it's a balance issue. Get the upgrade and it will sort of help you through the next phase.
Yes.
And that way, that also keeps the player occupied for a good while. I think it's very easy for the hours to zip by when you play this game.
Mm-hmm. So Rusty will not only be exploring the same desk as environments you see in the beginning, correct?
No, the it's sort of it's a multi-world setup. So you sort of run through different obstacles as you go along, and also different as the worlds change. And it's thematic in that way. You go through different thematic worlds on your way down. And then you sort of have to learn to deal with different types of obstacles and enemies. And it also, it becomes... In SteamWorld Dig, the terrain itself gets tricky because you think, okay, I'm supposed to dig this. How hard can it be?
Yes.
But then after a while, digging in itself becomes treacherous. And towards the end, you sort of have to be careful which paths you choose and so on.
It becomes a risk-reward game.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
That's a good way of putting it.
So what is an interesting itch about SteamWorld Dig is that the areas in the game are randomly generated. What made you decide for such a decision, and how do you feel it impacts replayability of the title?
Well, I'd say it affects replayability in a good sense, because you're not going to run directly for the caves and find them exactly in the spot where you expected to find them, mm-hmm. or where they were last time.
Yeah,
but it's a mix too. I mean, the minerals and so on that you're picking up are randomly placed, and the locations of the caves and so on, that's randomly placed. But all the caves are handmade, because they have to be so that you can actually solve them. As a regular platform game, how am I going to get from A to B? If that was all randomized, it would sort of steal away from the competition of the game. I mean, you could play a very easy game that way, and a friend would have maybe an impossible game.
Yeah, always must be a fair trade in that opinion.
Yeah.
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 So, another interesting thing what really appealed to me was the presentation of the title. So something I was particularly impressed with the usage of sprite art and combination of the 3D effects. What made you decide for this specific route?
Well, it's for us. It's pretty. It was a simple decision. We have an extraordinary art director in our office, and he is also the main producer of the graphic material. Mm-hmm. the graphic style of games is always his decision,
yes.
Finally. And it would be interesting if you somehow could could, in conjunction with this interview, if you could show the differences between Ant Hill and SteamWorld Dig, because they are very, very different types of games graphically.
Yeah.
But you can sort of see a thread there that we're always working with 2D graphics in our games, and it's hellish because there is so much work. The process to draw it and to animate it and to make it look good it takes forever, but it's really worth it because the presentation of image and form games is key. We're never going to step away from that. We always want to make lovely looking games.
And sprite art, in my opinion, also makes it more timeless.
Yeah. Yes, it does. Exactly.
Yeah.
That's a very interesting point. You could look at a 3D game that was made only 3 or 4 years ago, and you would definitely feel that it's dated already.
So, like, what were your biggest challenges like for developing for the 3DS? Because you have worked on the DSi before and on iOS, but what makes it so inherently different to you?
I'd say that working on the 3DS, it sounds like I'm heaping a lot of praise over my team, but I really think that they're a spectacular team. From the beginning with the 3DS, we had no hurdles that couldn't be overcome, and a great understanding really from the beginning. So we have some excellent programmers along with our excellent artists.
Yeah.
So that wasn't such a great hurdle in itself, not working with the 3DS. What was a very big hurdle for us was finding the fun factor in the game. Getting we prototyped the game and we thought, yeah, this would be fun. And then a month or so later, we were almost panicking because, God damn, it's not fun. Where's the fun in this game? And then we just decided to step back a little bit. And it's like, okay, we need to find the fun factor here. We cannot go on just hoping that we'll find it. We must find it now.
Yeah.
And so that was, I'd say that was the single most difficult thing in with SteamWorld Dig. It was finding the fun factor. And thank God we found it. We had decided on sort of a gameplay where you always had to think about how you dug your way because you wouldn't be able to jump up.
Mm-hmm.
And that was one of the things adding to the fun factor that we decided to, okay, set people free in this game. Let them dig any way they want. And wall jumping will take you up no matter how vertical you've been digging.
That's the one thing I like about the game. It can still be punishing at times, but having that wall jump on you makes that you always can progress in some fashion.
Yeah.
It does never stop.
Right, exactly. And if you get stuck, chances are that you actually get stuck in one spot, then we have this self-destruct option. You can actually self-destruct and lose half of your loot. Maybe you've been playing it so excellently that you haven't gotten into that situation, but you can actually end up in a pit or something where you've run out of steam. You won't be able to take yourself from that position, and then you can actually opt to self-destruct and sort of reemerge at the surface, but with half of your loot, half of your money gone, actually, because it costs a bit to put you once you self-destruct. It costs the repair shop a little bit to put you together again, but I'd say that developing for the 3DS, it was a challenge with the 3D and putting together the assets afterwards. That was a challenge, making the 3D videos and so on, because we had never done anything like that before. But again, I mean, the team read up on it and just magically put it together. I wish I could tell you how it was done, but I can't.
it's at least something to be proud of, I guess.
Yeah.
So beyond like SteamWorld Dig, are there like plans to do more with the SteamWorld series or support Nintendo systems more in the future, or is it some? Or am I speaking way beyond like this type of speaking terms? Because I'm sorry if I do that.
No, no, don't worry about it. I'm happy to speak about that.
Yeah,
we feel that at one point when we were making SteamWorld Dig, we were giving away very, very, very much of the story behind SteamWorld Dig. Well, basically what I told you before about the background. We sort of want to put that out in pieces in coming games in the SteamWorld series so that you get a better and better and better understanding of what has actually happened.
Yeah.
I think there's an interesting likeness to the Terminator series, where in the first movie you don't really understand how does this work, why did it happen, or how did it start, and you're not told that in the first movie. It's actually in the second movie where they actually tell most of the background, what has really happened.
Yes,
and I like that we have a universe that we can expand on, and we will expand on it. So that's one thing, expanding on the story. Another one is expanding on different types of games in SteamWorld.
Yeah.
I got the question earlier today in another forum, if we are looking towards Minecraft and Terraria and so on, and making a sandbox game would be thrilling. It would be very interesting to make that.
Yes.
And those games, both Minecraft and Terraria, I think are fabulous things. It's beautiful creations. SteamWorld Dig is not a sandbox game, but we're not alien to the thought of making it, of sort of experimenting with it anyway. But we're also thinking of lots of other types of gameplay.
Is the sandbox one that then most appeals to you, or is there like still another idea from this is where it should go?
Good, that's a good question. I think the sandbox idea is obviously, when you look at the success of Minecraft and Terraria, not only the economic success of that, but also the fun that they're bringing to all the people that are playing with it. That's a tremendous success, and by our standards here, because we want to make as high quality games as possible. I think that's a lovely achievement, that you have people who love your games so much that you will actually get stuck in it. You become a Minecrafter or a Terrarian. I think that's beautiful, and so the sandbox option, that's one way to go. I think there's a lot of work to be done if we want to keep the polish of SteamWorld Dig, if we want to keep the level of graphic detail and so on, then we have a lot of work ahead of us. But yeah,
it could be a taxing project as well.
Yeah, it definitely could, but that's one way to go. I think we're now looking at, actually we're following up in the SteamWorld series with a radically different sort of gameplay, and it's a game that we hopefully can finish up in not too long, so we can have a tail on SteamWorld Dig. But it tags in pretty well with both the personnel from SteamWorld Dig and also the main idea of the robots.
Is that coming to Nintendo platforms, or is that still up in the air?
It's Well, it's up in the air because we just started on it. I must say that we're very happy with Nintendo overall, and so we have no reason to leave the Nintendo 3DS platform. But if SteamWorld Dig becomes successful in the way we hope it will be, then one other way to go is also to or another path to that can run in parallel is porting SteamWorld Dig to other consoles, because it's a perfect console game.
Yeah.
So it could go to PlayStation or Xbox or even the Wii U.
I can see it working because the similar experience is there with all the information on the bottom screen and then playing it on the TV.
Yeah, exactly. That's very observant of you. And then, obviously, also we want to see if it can get put on PC. I think it'd be very playable there.
Mm-hmm.
It sort of depends on the reception here on Nintendo 3DS. If it works well,
yep.
Then we have something to take to that other company that starts with S on PC.
Which is an important player, of course. You can never deny the company with starting with the S.
No, exactly.
I think we're coming to the kind of to a close of the interview, but I want lastly, and I do this with every single interview I do, is I want to give you the chance to give like a final pitch for your game in roughly like a minute. So why should people like be excited for SteamWorld Dig? And
okay.
You can start whenever you like.
I think people should get SteamWorld Dig because it's a very fresh addition to the Nintendo 3DS and also to the eShop. It's a fabulously presented game, and the gameplay is very captivating. We call it a mining platform adventure game, and it means in the game you mine and collect resources. You jump around as you would in a platformer and dig your way down. And this is accompanied by a storyline that is compelling and also escalates to a climactic end. So you have a classic game, but in a very fresh setting and with very fresh twists to it.
It's very respectable. You did it in 45 seconds.
All right.
Yeah. You can still say, buy the game.
Buy the game!
There you go.
Well,
It has been very exciting. I've been playing it for a little bit, and it seems very promising so far. I want to save like my thoughts for like a review or for like another time, but no, I've been enjoying it so far. So thank you so much for letting me play it.
You're very welcome, Dan.
Yeah. And I think that's it for today. So I want to thank you, Brian, for being my guest and coming on this podcast and talking about all the stuff related to SteamWorld and the stuff that's ahead.
Thank you.
Alright, that will do it for this week's episode of Connectivity. As always, you can send us your listener mail to connectivity@nintendoworldreport.com. Be sure to rate and review us on iTunes. And follow all of us on Twitter. Go to nintendoworldreport.com and look for the Twitter sidebar on the right-hand side of the page, and you'll find all of our usernames there. We'll see you next week. We'll